I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Today, the media critics evaluate reporting of the 2016 election as the press corps faces accusations of gender bias and false equivalency in their coverage. To find out if those claims hold any merit, we'll examine reports from the campaign trail to the debate stage concerning the candidates' medical records, foreign policy, and some notorious deleted emails. How do you keep news coverage clean when the topic is a down and dirty slugfest? We'll find out. Finally, the latest edition of Local Listen with Bill Brownlee. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Good morning and welcome to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. I'm Steve Kraske. When it comes to media coverage of this year's presidential race, let's just say Donald Trump isn't the only one who's been crying foul. Savvy followers of the news think there's been gender bias and a false balance of coverage by media outlets. We'll ask if that's true in just a few minutes. First, though, the Missouri Court of Appeals Western District handed down a decision yesterday in the case of Rodney Lincoln, convicted of murdering a woman and sexually assaulting her two young daughters back in 1982. Lincoln has consistently maintained his innocence the entire time he's been serving his sentence. So when DNA evidence from the crime scene turned out not to belong to Rodney, and when the now-grown daughter who testified that it was Rodney Lincoln who committed the crimes recants her statement, it came as a shock when the appeals court did not grant his petition for habeas corpus. Joining us now from his office is Sean O'Brien. He's a professor at UMKC School of Law, and he's one of Rodney Lincoln's attorneys. Sean, always nice to have you. Good morning.
Well, good morning, Steve.
Sean, there were two major points supporting the court's conclusion here. The first was the DNA evidence, a pubic hair found at the scene that wasn't Rodney's. Why didn't the court give that finding, you know, more weight in its decision?
You know, that baffles me because the pubic hair, one of the pubic hairs that was definitively proved not to be Rodney's, was found lodged in the genitals of the four-year-old girl, a male pubic hair. We think that's pretty good indication that's the perpetrator's and it's not Rodney's hair.
The other significant point wasn't that the main witness has now recanted, but that the appeals court said it is restricted by the Missouri Supreme Court ruling in a case we're quite familiar with here, that of Joe Amrine. You handled that case, Joe. What specific point was holding the appeals court back?
Well, Joe Amrine's case, the Missouri Supreme Court said that a person on death row who presents clear and convincing evidence that he is innocent is entitled to a new trial. Rodney is not on death row. He is instead condemned to die in prison of natural causes. And so the court says that makes all the difference in the world, that Amrine applied only in a capital case. Rodney's not a capital case. They need the Missouri Supreme Court to tell them they have the power to grant relief to Rodney Lincoln.
Can the prosecutor's office petition the courts here to negate the conviction, Sean, and sentence if it agrees that Rodney's claim of innocence is valid? And is that going to happen?
The answer is yes and no. They do have that power. And in fact, the St. Louis circuit attorney in St. Louis City, where this prosecution originated, was attempting to do that when the attorney general's office stepped in and took over the case. And they have opposed Rodney's release tooth and nail ever since.
So the next step here is what? I mean, the state Supreme Court?
I think so. I think it's the state Supreme Court and asking them to extend the Amrine case to life sentence cases. I mean, the same principle has been applied in life sentence cases by the Missouri Supreme Court since the Amrine case. And so we're still scratching our heads over this decision of the court not to grant relief in this case.
And if you wind up at the state Supreme Court, Sean, do you make the same arguments there as you did at the appellate level?
We do. Basically, the argument we're trying to make is that it is a miscarriage of justice to incarcerate a person who can be proved innocent by clear and convincing evidence. There is no evidence linking Rodney to this crime. None at all. The only evidence that survives from the original trial is the testimony of Rodney's employer that he showed up at work on time that day, and Rodney's mother that he stayed all night, you know, he slept all night in his own bed, ate breakfast, and left for work at the usual time that morning. So he's got a really solid alibi. That's the only evidence that survives.
We'll want to keep tabs on this case as we go forward here. That's Sean O'Brien, professor at UMKC School of Law and one of Rodney Lincoln's attorneys. Sean, thanks very much.
Thank you, Steve.
How good a job has the news media done in covering election 2016? Now, there's a topic that stirs people up no matter which side of the partisan divide you reside on. Critics of the media have raised all kinds of concerns, from Donald Trump's dominance of all media to concerns that a double standard has been applied to this case. That is, have reporters succumbed to gender bias in covering Hillary Clinton? And there's this notion that some media outlets are guilty of false balance, or this notion that in their pursuit of objectivity, they present each side of a debate as equally credible, even when the factual evidence is stacked heavily on one side. Joining me now to talk about all this, Derek Donovan is the reader's representative for the Kansas City Star. Derek, always nice to have you.
Good to be here.
Mike Williams is a professor of journalism at the University of Kansas. Mike, thanks for driving over.
Thank you. Glad to be back.
Peggy Lowe is the investigations editor at Harvest Public Media, based here at KCUR. Peggy, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Well, let's dive right into this. We got an email from a loyal listener. Her name is Anne, and she wrote us to say how concerned she is about the media coverage of this presidential race. She said she had heard far more about Secretary Clinton's failure to disclose her pneumonia immediately than she had about some of Donald Trump's more flamboyant foreign policy views. Ultimately, she wonders if gender bias or this idea of false equivalency is at play here. Peggy, is it?
I have to say I disagree with Anne on this one.
Really?
I really think that the press has been very tough on Hillary, as they absolutely should be. Mm-hmm. And they've been very tough on Trump, too. The thing about the pneumonia that I think some people didn't get, the media is guilty of covering the horse race too much, and they're guilty of covering how candidates are posing. And I think a lot of the coverage that I read at that time was that Hillary should have disclosed that she had pneumonia early on, taken those days off. It had to sort of come out when we saw that video of her collapsing. And I think most of the criticism around that was that she handled it poorly. And I think she did handle it poorly. Mm-hmm. So I guess I'm sorry, Anne, I just don't agree with you on
Not
that
buying
one.
It. Mm-hmm. Derek, what do you think?
Secrecy is something that the public is really come to sort of expect, that a lot of politicians keep a lot of things from them. And particularly in the internet age, everybody thinks that they've got hidden information. Everybody thinks that there's a story behind the story. And I think that Hillary Clinton did herself a huge disservice by not being more forthcoming about that. You know, she probably thought, well, I can power through this, and I'm not going to make a deal out of it because I don't want to present myself as weak. Because, of course, that is something that has been out there buzzing for a long time. There's this conspiracy theory that, you know, she's actually gravely ill, and she didn't want to play into that in any way.
Mm-hmm.
And also, don't forget that Hillary and Bill Clinton both have a long history of being a little bit not being as forthcoming with the press,
right?
Going way back to their Arkansas days. So this is kind of a pattern of them. They kind of bunker down, and, you know, she's famous for not giving press conferences and these things that journalists keep hammering her on, rightfully so. She's going for the highest office in the land.
Mike Williams, let me try another example that Anne pointed to. She says she heard reporters and talk show hosts, maybe not me, I hope, discuss Hillary Clinton's release of medical records from her physician and Donald Trump's choice to present medical information on a talk show, as though both of those met the same disclosure standards. You may recall that Trump released a note from his doctor declaring that he was in excellent physical health, but he declined to release a more detailed history. What about it, Mike?
Well, I think this has been the campaign all along. The media has been giving a pass to just about everything that the Trump campaign has to say about anything. And the fact that they would not equate a note that was written in a fairly shorthand manner, as we've seen in the media since then, with a full medical report that Hillary chose to share, You could argue that that's the same with the taxes that haven't come out. You could argue that's the same with many of the differences between how each campaign has presented their candidates. It's not the same, and I think that's where the difference comes about.
Has the media pointed out that difference adequately, in your view, Mike?
I don't think they did at the first. I think when we had conversations about this a month ago, I think there was a significant difference in the way the coverage was going for both candidates, about both candidates.
You think it's shifted?
I do think it's shifted. I think probably the first debate caused an awareness of the differences, and I think some of the criticism of the moderators of the first debate played into that. And I think that the media has finally started to realize that the show that is the Trump campaign is a show, and the show that is Hillary's campaign is trying to be a bit more focused in a more traditional manner.
So again, a shift.
Most certainly. I think so.
Peggy Lowe, you're nodding your head.
Absolutely agree with you. I mean, we were all at the Dole Institute for your can I call it a dog and pony show? No, I'm sorry.
That's
we were the dogs and the ponies.
Yes.
Anyway, we were all on the same panel.
What does that make me? If you were the dogs and the ponies, what was I? Yeah.
So, I mean, just even a month ago, I think it has changed dramatically. I think it has devolved since then. And I do think the media has stepped up since then. More often than not, we're hearing reporters saying, Trump lied about that. Trump lied about that, using the correct verb, not just like he dodged it or whatever, but really that it was a falsehood. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's changed a great deal in the last month.
We get our listeners to chime in here what they think of the coverage of this presidential race. I bet there's a few opinions out there. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Again, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Derek Donovan, from Ombudsman from the Star, has there been a shift that Mike and Peggy are alluding to here? Are you buying that?
You know, I think it's so subjective on the viewer. In my opinion, a lot of people were looking at the early days and actually up into just the past few months of the Trump campaign, still with a little bit of a bemused incredulity that we're actually seeing this happen. You know, as many people have pointed out, The Simpsons played this for straight up laughs not all that long ago. And I think that the realization that this is really happening has sort of maybe kicked some reporters into a little bit of a higher gear, as Peggy was saying, with just flatly saying that we've never seen a presidential candidate that has used this level of mendacity before. There is nothing that precedes it, you know, and so just objectively saying that's false is kind of a bedrock responsibility of reporters, and they should have been doing it much more strongly from the beginning, I think.
You know, can we agree that this has not been an easy race for the news media to cover? And I'll point to a couple things. You know, the race began going back to late last year, 17 Republican candidates, the largest field in the history of the Republic. That's a tough challenge for reporters to wrap our collective arms around when you cover, you know, how do you get 17 opinions about raising the minimum wage in one story, Peggy? And then obviously the Clinton-Bernie Sanders race, the different challenges that Donald Trump has posed in terms of accurate statements, truthful statements. It ain't been easy, has it?
It's been very difficult. You're right. There were so many people running for the GOP nomination. That was difficult early on. No one believed Trump would win it. You know, I think, right. You know, there was just, it's so unbelievable, and we have such a surreal situation. So I think that's part of it. And I have to say, too, and of course, I'm going to show my bias here as a member of the mainstream media, but in the beginning, the media was roundly criticized for giving Trump all this free media, that they covered every crazy thing he did. And now, then towards the middle, they're saying we're not covering him enough, that we haven't said it was a lie, that we haven't said it's a falsehood. Mm-hmm. Right now, the media can't do anything right. And really, they're killing the messenger a lot this year. So I would suggest that they were up against some really, really tough situations, and they're doing the best they can, and they're making it up as they go, because this is such a different year.
Kind of say that anybody who hosts a presidential debate, who moderates one of those things, deserves a presidential medal Medal of Valor or whatever they give away. Boy, I think that's just an absolutely no-win proposition for anybody.
And I have to say, Anderson Cooper and Martha Raddatz did an astonishing job this time.
They kept the reins on the candidates. Mm-hmm. Mike, how tough of a job has it been for the media this year to cover a race like this?
Well, I think this is an example where the national media is at a real disadvantage, because even in the time from the previous election, 2012, to now, the multiples of coverage and the multiple sources of information has exploded and expanded as the internet continues to grow and be part of everybody's life. And so I think what's happening is, at the local level, I think local media are still doing their good job. The trouble is, the local media don't cover the presidential campaigns. That's the national media. And when you start to look at, instead of three networks from not that long ago to eight or nine now that are pretty much on the bus, if you will, with the candidates,
right?
Just the sheer number of people that are having to try to disseminate the information, you're going to get differences of opinion regardless. But I think that the candidates recognize it and play to that. Hmm. And so I think there's where you're starting to get the failure. And then you also have to include the commercial value in terms of time on air that each candidate and then each network gets out of the process of how much coverage they give to this. Mm-hmm. The more they're out there, the more people pay attention to the CNNs or the Foxes and that sort of thing, and that translates into dollars.
816-235-2888 is our number here. Tweet us at KCUR UpToDate. Derek, what's your two cents here?
You know, I think that a lot of what we're seeing is people talking about media sources that they consume that are very niche, you know, and the alternative media has become such a huge part of a very tiny proportion of the overall population's daily media news consumption. National Review recently did a very long look at what it kind of considers the failure of the alternative conservative media, where it pointed out that the people who believe that, you know, those, particularly Breitbart and Drudge Report are the ones we're talking about, and Fox News to a certain degree, particularly their talk show hosts. The people who consume that media really voraciously, and that, you know, a lot of their identity is tied up in that, is a very, very small sliver of the electorate. And it's actually a small sliver of those people who probably consider themselves Republican or conservative in general. Mm-hmm. And so National Review's point is that by the Trump campaign thinking that that is really their core voter, they have made a fatal mistake. And they are going after marketing themselves after a very, very tiny little demographic. But, you know, what National Review was pointing out is that the average person doesn't even know who Rush Limbaugh is. Now, to those of us who are media people, we think that's absurd. But actually, the science, the social science, bears that out, that those sources, they simply don't have penetration into the mainstream.
That's interesting. Let's go to some phone calls here. Imani from Kansas City, Missouri. Imani, welcome to Up to Date.
Thank you so much, Steve. Thank you for taking my call. This is a political campaign, and it's being treated at like reality TV. My problem is the focus that the mainstream media is putting on the groping and the pneumonia. I don't want to know about that kind of stuff. I want to know about voting records. I want to know about policy. I want to know about who's contributing to whose campaign and the influence that those people are exerting. I think that the media has a responsibility to help produce or foster an informed populace. And I think they're shirking that responsibility.
You know, Mike Williams, has the media gone too far, to Imani's point, in terms of playing this campaign for ratings and advertising revenue and not doing the job that Imani is pointing out needs to be done?
Yes, I've said that several times. And I think the reference to the reality TV show thing is actually, in some senses, goes all the way back to the earlier comment about the number of candidates we had. You think about The Apprentice, you think about Bachelor, you think about any of those shows on TV, they start with a large group of people and they kind of weed them down into whatever. One of the criticisms I heard from, I read about the last debate, the one on Sunday, was that it wasn't a town hall at all. It was much more about the two moderators pretty much trying to step up to be the moderators that they thought they should be, mm-hmm. rather than letting the people who were there, voluntarily or otherwise, communicate with the candidates. And so if you think about it, I think they were only 8 questions from the public.
Right.
And otherwise, it was the moderators trying to keep the candidates reined in.
Let me ask a hard question here, because the criticism that Imani makes is a good one. And my question is this. You know, you hear this from some serious-minded voters and readers and listeners that they want more issues coverage. And yet, Mike, Derek, you know, Peggy, you also read in the journalism media, the stuff that we pay attention to and about our industry, that readers and listeners aren't as interested in issue coverage as they say they are. They really are interested in, you know, the more salacious things that come out in a campaign like this. How do you is that true?
I think Imani's criticism is really fair, that there hasn't been a lot of policy coverage. That said, Donald Trump doesn't have specifics. As a reporter, how do you talk to him about the trade deals, the minimum wage, environment? How do you talk to a guy who doesn't have plans?
Nor a voting record.
Right. So, I mean, absolutely, people have talked a lot about what Hillary stands for, and there's a lot of information out there. And now in the age of the internet, there's a lot of things that you can go and find those things out. So to that end, people like Imani who want that can find it. But I agree. I'm more of a policy wonk. I'd like to see more of that covered, too.
Are the Star's readers want more policy coverage legitimately, or they just say they do, Derek?
Well, I think the question really is, are the people who are really informed about those things and interested in that, really, do they have any questions about these two candidates' positions on this at this point? I mean, Hillary Clinton has, I would say, probably one of the most lengthy resumes ever of a presidential candidate. We know what she stands for on these things. And as Peggy says, Trump, you know, he has nonsense. He doesn't have any specifics. He has no voting record. So, Monty, love you. And I think I wish we had a lot more people like you out there, you know, because,
yeah,
boy, you would surely make a very informed electorate. But I'm just not sure people really have those concerns, because if you really are wondering about those types of things, the decision's pretty clear for you. You know?
Yeah, Mike.
I think people are probably wanting it now just to get sort of some sense of normalcy about this election.
Mm-hmm.
I think they're tired of hearing about tapes on buses and every other variation of strange things that have come out in the last several weeks. I honestly think that they would sort of relish a few weeks of some serious debate about what the election is really going to mean.
Let's go back to some calls. Richard from Kansas City, Missouri. Richard, you're on UpToDate. Nice to have you.
Thank you. Good morning. Thanks for the discussion.
Good morning.
A lot's been said about the reporting of the horse race aspect, but I think it goes beyond that. It's not just that you need to report what's said, including what's said on the bus, but it's how it's reported. And I'll give one example. When Trump made claims that Hillary had started the whole birther thing a few weeks ago, at one point, NPR said in their headline news, Donald Trump said today, blah, blah, blah. And then they said, this claim is false, meaning that it's inaccurate. It's false. On the same, approximately the same day, I think it was on NPR's morning edition, the host said, Donald Trump made a bold statement today about Hillary Clinton starting the birther issue. It's not a bold statement. It's an inaccurate statement. And that's where I think the press falls down. And to be fair, there's just an avalanche of stuff from the Trump campaign, one after the other. It's like, what did Trump say today? But if two people from the Flat Earth Society walked into NBC News and said, hey, the Earth's not round, you're not going to see a discussion on NBC the next day that says, you know, society says Earth is not round. Let's discuss. It's inaccurate.
Right,
it's
right.
False. And that's where the media falls down, I think. And really, it's not that you shouldn't cover Donald Trump. It should be qualified.
Yeah, let me get our panel to respond to what you're saying here, Richard. You were referring to this earlier. Richard raises this idea of false balance, this idea that in their pursuit of objectivity, journalists sometimes present each side of a debate as equally credible. You were saying before, Peggy, that you're hearing and seeing the media now more often call out Donald Trump and label his claims as a lie. Was the media too slow to get to that point?
Absolutely. And I'll give you a case in point. The New York Times, they were out early and often on some really good investigations. For instance, they connected Trump's campaign manager, Manafort, with the Ukraine lobbying, you know, and his kind of weird ties to Putin. They had stuff about the 1995 taxes. You know, the Times had some really good scoops. They did not report, however, things like, okay, Trump is lying when he says this. That was a falsehood. The Washington Post was out early and often on that. And they really led the way, I feel, in that kind of reporting. So I thought that was fantastic. The other highlight, I think, that's going to come out of media studies later on this is that there were things that changed this year, obviously. And we've been making these changes in real time. One of the best examples, if I can give your listeners this one, is a guy named David Farenthold of The Washington Post. He's been the guy reporting the most on the Trump Foundation. And he literally, and I love this as an old school reporter, he didn't put his information in like Excel spreadsheets and do all that data that most of the data crunchers do. He actually has long sheets of notebook paper written in longhand of his notes, and they're online. And they notate it, like he goes back and says, yes, this group, you know, did give money, or that group. And it's fantastic. And he puts it out in real time on Twitter, too. So I would really, if people are really into that kind of, you know, wonky journalism, I would follow David Farenthold on Twitter if I were you.
Mike Williams, this is a change for the mainstream media, though. I've never seen the media so blatantly call a candidate out and say, this claim is a lie, that claim is a lie. This is a new era. Was the media too slow getting here?
Oh, absolutely. And I think the problem is, and we've mentioned this before, is that it's just been such a flood of untruths. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the things that's changed most recently, and I think this is where the media could pick up the slack a little bit, is they've started to actually do the count of how many falsehoods are spoken on any given debate or any given day. I honestly think that if they did something as simple as a chart, okay, today Trump said this many things, 73% were false, or totally false, the whole pants on fire thing.
Right.
When they started to count them, as in how many mistruths or untruths there were during their debate, for example, and the numbers are so dramatically opposed to each other, I think that's when it – the media tries too hard sometimes to justify something they say with lots of other details. And I think we are at a point where all that extra detail just gets in the way.
Although one of the things I think that is very exciting as somebody who likes journalism is, you know, Peggy talking about a reporter actually putting his homework out online for everybody to scrutinize. That's thrilling. And, you know,
it's so cool.
Yeah, 25 years ago in this industry, particularly people who worked for legacy newspaper companies, you know, they had kind of the luxury of sitting back and saying, well, I don't need to show you. You know, I work for the Washington Post and I you know, you can just take it on my authority. And I think it's really great that the entrepreneurial spirit of particularly the web is really starting to make its way into a place like the Washington Post. That is fantastic, because that's good journalism no matter who's doing it.
Another thing, too, is everything is coming faster. We've talked for years now about the 24-hour news cycle.
Yeah.
I mean, it's crazy how fast everything moves. I noticed in Saturday morning's Times, it was the whole layout of Trump and Billy Bush and the tape and all that baloney. But the lead editorial in the New York Times that morning was fantastic because it said, okay, this is what this means. We have a GOP presidential nominee on record as a sexual assaulter. On record, this is rape culture in America, people. And I love that the editorial was turned around that quickly.
Wow, interesting. Let's do this. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll talk with our media critics and continue our conversation. We're going to talk about gender bias in the media and this notion that men anchor evening news broadcasts at a 60% clip. They get 63% of the bylines compared to women in print, different forms of media. We're going to talk about that and what it means for gender bias. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. On yesterday's show, we asked people in the Native American community, what does it mean to be American now? And we examined our country's history of policing the world. You can find those conversations at kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, we discuss the impact Latinos have had on the Midwest over the past 20 years and a granny basketball game that's reignited the Kansas-Missouri rivalry. I'm Curious to know what that is myself. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. This hour, visiting with our media critics, Derek Donovan from The Star, Mike Williams from the University of Kansas, Peggy Lowe, who's with Harvest Public Media based here at KCUR. Some phone calls still waiting. I'm going to go to them right now. 816-235-2888 is the number here. Teresa from Lenexa. Teresa, good morning.
Hi, Steve. Thanks so much. My question is, why is the media not making a much stronger point about the fact that Hillary Clinton has been vetted, severely vetted, for over 30 years? Donald Trump has been vetted for maybe a year, maybe 18 months, more really and truly serious vetting in the last six. And in the entire 30-plus years that Hillary Clinton has been through investigations, has just been hammered, she has never, ever been accused of saying or doing anything as appalling as glorifying sexual assault or praising dictators around the world. That's my question. Why, if God only knows what we would have if Donald Trump had been vetted for 30 years.
Okay. I got your point here, Teresa. Thank you. And is there a difference here with the amount of time that Trump's been vetted versus Hillary Clinton? And would our view of Donald Trump be substantially different if he had been?
Well, again, here's one of the biggest problems, Teresa, is that, again, Trump has no voting record. He has no public policy experience. And so in all of the examples of apples and oranges, I cannot find really a better one than that. Trump's been a public figure, though, as long as Hillary Clinton has. You know, don't forget, he's got a TV and movie appearance and string going back to the 80s, the same that she does, really. And in a lot of those ways, he's kind of the butt of the joke. I mean, you remember him going on Letterman, where, you know, essentially he would come on and Letterman would make fun to his face for years and years and years. So, you know, he is still a very much a public figure, but he just doesn't have anything for you to go on. You don't know, other than his bankruptcies, you really don't know anything about his actual business dealings because he keeps it all private.
And he wasn't a candidate. Mm-hmm. You know, he has said, Chris Matthews had a clip on last night on MSNBC, and he asked Trump point blank, are you going to run for anything? And this was like in 06, 09, something like that. And Trump denied it. He said, absolutely not. And so you're not vetted if you're not a candidate. And he hasn't been until this year.
Okay. Go back to some calls here. Tom's been waiting a while here for us. Tom from Rosedale. Nice to have you, Tom.
Good morning. I just want to say, I know it's entertaining, but I think the media spends way too much time telling us what the candidates or the campaigns need to do to get votes. I think that's the job of the campaigns, to work, look after themselves. I'd rather have the media do investigative reporting or to flesh out all these policy proposals we need to know about. So I think they've gone into entertainment and not into information.
I got you, Tom. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
You know, it's not lost on me that men anchor evening news broadcasts at a 60% clip, according to the Women's Media Center. Men get 63% of the bylines in print and online stories. I'm wondering, how much of a factor is that, Mike Williams? Does that begin to suggest that just inherently the media shifts a little bit, leans a little bit to men over women?
Well, we know that the newsrooms are staffed that way, and we're making progress there. I think we're at about a 2-to-1 ratio of female to male students in our school, anyway, at KU.
Female to male?
Mm-hmm.
No kidding. Yeah.
But I think back to the point that one of the other callers made is whether we vetted Trump pre-candidacy or not, we're making Hillary go through more questions and more depth reporting, if you will, about her background than we have about Trump. I mean,
is that still the case?
I think it's still the case. Mm-hmm. And I think if you talk to anyone who's female, who's gone for a job or applied for a job or a raise or a promotion, they would tell you, and there's lots of sociology out there, I'm sure, that proves it, that women have a harder time of pushing themselves, promoting themselves, getting their message out.
A lot of folks think electing a woman president is a bigger challenge for the country than electing the first African-American, for instance.
Well, I agree. And I think that ism, if you will, you know, anti-female versus anti-African-American is very much at play here.
Yeah. Peggy, weigh in on this.
No offense, Steve, but duh. I mean, yeah, this has been going on forever.
Just ask the questions here, Peggy. Yeah, yeah.
I mean, of course it has been. You know, I've been in the media now for longer than I should say, but a lot of times I think that there's reasons for this. For instance, it's really hard to be a mom and be a journalist, okay? I'm not one. I'm not a parent, so I'm still okay. I've worked crazy hours. I've worked holidays all my life. My family's thrilled they finally get to see me now on holidays. Mm-hmm. I worked with a single mom back in the 90s at the Associated Press in Denver. She worked the overnight shift so she could take her kid to school that morning and pick him up. It's stuff like that. It's sacrifices like that that women have had to make. And then they don't want to make that. And they get out. And yes, they're paid less too. So yeah, it's still a problem. It's gotten better. And I think you've seen news coverage get better in the last 20 years because of women entering this workforce. But yeah, it's still a chronic problem.
Okay. We go to Florence from Kansas City, Kansas. Florence, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. I'd like to ask the journalist on your panel this morning, do they see the recent linked revelations, do they have any relevance to what the two candidates are publicly professing?
I'm not sure I'm following you, Flo.
Do the most linked revelations have any relevance to what the two candidates are publicly professing?
Are you talking about the sexual assault comments, Florence?
Those and Hillary Clinton's speeches to Wall Street and Goldman Sachs.
I'm struggling here. Recast the question for me, Mike, because I'm struggling with where we're going here.
If I can, I think what I'm hearing is what we've heard mostly over the last five days, has been the bus stuff and the leak of Hillary's speeches to Wall Street. And I think the trouble is that they're so on such different planes of mm-hmm. concern. I think there's relevance, absolutely, in both of them. If a candidate is basically admitted that he's a sexual assaulter, that's absolutely relevant. I think the interpretation of her speeches and how that came out in the debate, I thought that was probably one of the lower moments for her at the debate. You know, mm-hmm. the whole Abe Lincoln reference was pretty strange. Mm-hmm. And I think we haven't heard enough about how that whole part of her background has played into her campaign. And I think all we did is basically get an affirmation of what we'd already heard and thought about Trump in that part.
Okay.
And I thought it was very strange that when that issue has come up for Hillary, that she hasn't been a little bit more real politic about it and said, duh, I've been a public servant for all these years and I tailor my message to my audience. And I don't think it should come as any surprise to anybody that I do a lot of compromise and that I am willing to change my message to work with other people. And sometimes, yes, I will tell one group what they want to hear at this time. But, you know, I'm still an open book when it comes to my voting record and those types of things.
Okay. Back to some calls here. Let me go to Anita from Overland Park. Anita, good morning.
Good morning. Great talk, everybody.
Good. Thanks.
Well, what I wanted to say is, you know, the comment was made that Donald Trump has not been a candidate, so he therefore couldn't be vetted before. But since he is now a candidate, isn't what he's done, what he said, his taxes, his isn't that his record, and shouldn't that be vetted? I mean, you know, should
yeah.
you know, and also, I wanted to also comment that, since he doesn't have any policies or plans, shouldn't that be pointed out? I mean, shouldn't media you know, say, well, what is your plan? How do you do that? I mean, you can't just make America great again. I mean, there has to be a plan.
Hey, has the media adequately vetted Trump when it comes to his business track record? Because I think I would point to the New York Times and say they've done a lot of that stuff. It's obviously their backyard, but been a lot of that stuff in the Times in recent months, and maybe other outlets as well.
They have done a lot of that. I would also suggest that the media is really up against one of the toughest people ever to cover because he's so secretive. He will not release his taxes. You know, a lot of these lawsuits that he had were settled with privacy statements. So it's really difficult to get to a guy when you can't get to the public documents that back up his record.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and I think in some ways, getting to the documents takes more time, and I don't think the media was quite as in, because they didn't have it, they didn't think to do much with it, and it's taken time. But I think this probably more than anything else is the best indicator that the media has started to come around to trying to get deeper into their coverage of both candidates.
Leslie tweeted this, fans of alternative liberal media aren't a small sliver of the population as some believe. Because of this election, mainstream media is dead to many of us. Okay.
Whoa.
Yeah, let me go back to Chris from Kansas City, Missouri. Chris, good morning.
Hi, I couldn't agree with that last statement more. If we can't get policy out of Trump, I'm his demographic. I was a supporter. Now I'm repulsed. We need to know more about his character if we can't get his policies. For example, his apprentice shows has dozens of tapes, they say, with much stronger statements than already been released. At what time does the public right to know for a presidential candidate overcome a confidentiality agreement? Also, there's things like the Russian connection, hacking of emails. We need some strong investigative reporting here, not pandering to reality show. And I feel the press this is a death knell for our press.
Okay. Chris, thank you. Mike?
Well, this is the problem we face in our profession now, is the newspapers, the magazines, the TV stations, the radio stations that have the resources, whether they be bodies or dollars, are the mainstream media that everybody's, you know, kissing the death kiss to here. And mm-hmm. and so that's the challenge. Sliver media, niche media, the small groups don't have the resources to go deep into this kind of stuff. So that's why we need the mainstream media to improve.
Of course,
survive.
One of the big challenges there too is, gosh, you know, Trump's a tough nut to crack, but now you want to go after an ex-KGB guy and try to find out what's really going on with Putin. I mean, good luck to you. That is something that's probably going to be Herculean.
So your point is, if he won't release his tax returns, I mean, short of the leaks that the New York Times got, we can't get at what he's really all about.
I think that's largely true, unless you're going to get somebody from inside the IRS or something that's going to come forth with their own, you know, kind of Pentagon
papers. And just for the record, the New York Times, which published the story based on the leak tax returns, faces perhaps legal action. Trump has been threatening several times legal action for publishing what it published. So, you know, there's a few $1 million there perhaps on the line.
To that same thing, though, there's a bill in Congress right now that has pretty strong bipartisan support to require presidential candidates to release their taxes. And there's some hope that that will even get passed before we get to November 8th.
Yeah. I'm wondering about third-party candidates while we have this good media panel here today, the Libertarians and the Green Party. Are they getting enough coverage? Is the media paying attention there? And I can't help but wonder, the Libertarian candidate Gary Johnson makes the one slip of the tongue when it comes to Syria, and it seemed like his campaign just tanked. In comparison, both, you know, mainstream candidates, Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump, numerous slips of the tongue, and they're still, you know, where they are. Interesting dynamic there.
I've covered a lot of political campaigns, and the Green Party and the Libertarians, any third parties, are always upset at you as a political reporter, as you well know, Steve.
Because you don't give them enough play.
Because you don't give them enough play. And so you say things like, well, first of all, you're probably not going to get even a quarter of the vote, so I'm not going to give you a lot of time. And they say, well, maybe I would get a quarter or more if you did give me more time. The other thing is a practical consideration. In a newspaper, you just have so much space, and a radio spot, maybe 40 seconds if it's NPR.
But who are you to say, Peggy, that the Libertarian candidate shouldn't get as much play as a Democratic or Republican candidate's? What gives you the right to make that judgment?
Well, the right is just something that we claim because we know what's going to happen. Okay. I guess. Yeah. I guess I don't have the right, is it, to be really honest, but in practical terms,
that's what happens.
That's what happens.
Yeah.
I think Al Gore would suggest that third-party candidates do make a difference, and and I think it has to deal with more about the public value, the public face of who the candidate is. I mean, the name recognition thing is a critical part of this, and so when you have people who are not widely known, as this year's candidates in the third parties are.
Yeah,
I think that's why Nader did as well as he did in that election, is because he was known.
It's the ultimate chicken and egg argument, and the libertarians in particular have been making this case to me for many years at the Star, because they believe, and I think they probably have quite a bit of a point here, that they think that there could be a lot of appeal if people realized that there was a fiscally conservative party out there that didn't get into the moral issues. Mm-hmm. And they say, gosh, if you gave us more coverage, then I think we would find a lot of disaffected Republican voters who would like to go for us. But at the same time, it's also very much like the case of bills that are introduced basically as stunt legislation that have no legitimate political chance of getting, you know, even out of committee. Do you cover every one of those things as though they're a real political reality, when you know, as a seasoned journalist, that no, somebody's just doing this, you know, to get on a soapbox? And I think you can make a case that that's not responsible journalism.
We're talking with our media critics about the coverage of this year's presidential race. Let's go back to some calls. And Mary from Kansas City, Missouri. Mary, welcome. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I was wondering whether or not what your panelists think as it relates to the loss of the fairness doctrine in the late 1980s and the advent of the 24-hour news cycle as it relates to the civility of the discourse that we see, or lack thereof, in political campaigns since then, and whether or not anything like that could ever be reinstated and what impact it might have.
What was the fairness doctrine, Mike?
Well, basically, in so many words, if you gave X amount of time in coverage on a network, you had to give the same amount of time to the other candidate.
And the fairness doctrine is gone now?
For all intents and purposes. I mean, when you have more cable networks and more non-network licensed networks out there, that was sort of the stick that you could hold over. It was your network license.
And Mary's wondering, do we need the fairness doctrine?
Yes, I think in a sense. Now, the only way I think it would ever come back is if we were to completely redo the whole election process and do much like other democracies do, and say the government says, here's X number of dollars, that's all you can spend, it's a finite amount of time that you can campaign. At that point, you have a stick again that you can hold over the candidates.
One of the things you have to realize, too, is that our media landscape today has become entertainment for a lot of people. And I liken it to people rooting for a football team, that there are some folks out there, and I think they're a fairly small percentage of the population, who really love sticking it to the other side. And those are the folks on the left who are always posting on my Facebook feed stuff from OccupyDemocrats.com, mm-hmm. or the people on the right who are always sharing the Breitbart stuff. They're not really trying to, these are not people who are really in any way undecided about any of these issues. They know they're going to vote straight ticket, and that is something that is very different. I think it kind of started with Crossfire. Those of you who remember Crossfire back in in the 80s on CNN. But, you know, now we've got these really partisan outlets that are competing tooth and nail for their ratings, for their viewers, and for their clicks.
We're going to have to leave our good conversation there. I want to thank our very good media critics, Peggy Lowe from Harvest Public Media here, based here at KCUR, Mike Williams, a professor of journalism at KU, Derek Donovan, the reader's representative for the Kansas City Star. Great conversation. Thanks for coming in. And I guess we solved all the problems, right?
Sure we did.
Something like that. Coming up, Bill Brownlee in this week's Local Listen. Bill Brownlee's here, and he wants to talk about a group, Various Blonde, for this week's Local Listen. How are you, man?
I'm great, thanks.
Yeah, good. Who's Various Blonde?
Various Blonde is one of Kansas City's best rock bands, or at least, Steve, they were one of Kansas City's best rock bands. In 2014, they released an album called Summer High. It's a psychedelic rock extravaganza produced by Ike Owens of Mars Volta, who died a few months after the record was released. It was fantastic, but not many people cared. So if you can't beat them, join them. Various Blonde's new album joins the dance rock revolution.
Hmm. This new album is titled All Bases Covered. Here's the title track, It's Various Blonde. Blonde, you know, Bill, they're described as an indie rock band, but there's a whole lot going on with that sound, isn't there?
Yeah, that's right. You know, area venues are filled up every week with, you know, DJs on stage playing dance music for the kids, doing songs about, just like this one, about getting blacked out and, you know, completely decadent, you know, lyrics. But, you know, I think Josh Allen, the leader of Various Blonde, kind of does it the right way here.
It seems like there's this trend out there these days, you know, groups crossing over from genre to genre, and this seems to fit that category pretty nicely.
Yeah, if you look at the pop charts or, you know, even on the country playlist, you're going to hear lots of dance music these days, and, you know, that's just the way it is. Dance music, for whatever reason, is dominating popular music right now, and Various Blonde is jumping on that bandwagon.
You know, Various Blonde performs at the Fed Up Fest at Crossroads, Kansas City at 5 p.m. on Saturday. Who's headlining that festival?
There's a band from Milwaukee, an indie pop duo called Sylvanesso. A Fed Up Fest is an all-day benefit concert for the Harvester's Food Bank. And all kinds of music from the alternative bluegrass of Split Lip Rayfield to a crazy marching band called March 4th. And Various Blonde at 5.
And Various Blonde released their music on a fairly well-known label, didn't they?
Yeah, they're on the Record Machine, a label that puts out a lot of the most notable bands in town, like the Philistines, for instance.
Yeah. That's Bill Brownlee talking about the group Various Blonde. Bill, always appreciate it. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Steve.
Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. You can follow me at Steve Kraske. Tomorrow, we'll talk about the Latino influence in the Midwest over the past 20 years, and we'll learn about a basketball game between grannies that's reignited the Kansas-Missouri border war, if you can believe it. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, Ryan Hennessy, and Corinne Dorian. Our senior producer, he's Steven Steigman. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.